Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a courageous doctor who has treated and ministered the rural population of eastern Honduras for over 25 years. Dr. Amanda Madrid is the Chief Medical Officer and Director of the Christian Medical Ministry Predizan, which serves the mountainous region in and around Catacamas, Honduras. Population of the city is around 100,000, and another 100,000 people live in mountain villages so remote that at certain times of the year, the only accessible way to visit is by horseback. For most of this time, Dr. Madrid's biggest enemies have been endemic poverty and the vagaries of subsistence farming for the residents of the area. But in recent years, when conflict over the land usage between residents and drug traffickers resulted in a deadly war and the closing of the mountain clinics, Dr. Madrid boldly waded into the conflict and helped broker an uneasy truce between the cartel mercenaries and local landowners so that the clinics could reopen and the people could be served. Her story is recounted by a local Broken Arrow minister, Greg Taylor, in his book, Lay Down Your Guns, One Doctor's Battle for Hope and Healing in Honduras. And I'm joined by Dr. Amanda Madrid today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Madrid, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's just a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your work in Honduras. Predizan, it's a medical community that the name actually combines healing and prayer.
Actually, the name is two Spanish words, you know, preaching and healing. It's predicar in Spanish and sanar. You know, so that's what the word predizan means.
Now, how did this group get started?
It started 25 years ago. A missionary couple from Atlanta, Georgia, went down to train preachers to be a community healthcare workers. And the husband of the couple was a physician, and they needed a physician, a Honduran physician that would work with them. And my brother was one of the preachers in the city and in the capital. And through him, you know, they contact me, you know, knowing that I was a member of one of the churches and was a physician. But I used to live in the capital, you know. I was not planning to go to the Wild West.
That's Tegucigalpa.
I was living in Tegucigalpa at that time, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you mentioned this is the Wild West.
Well, it's kind of the way that it's been called, you know, because it's in the eastern part of the country. It's not the west, it's the east. Mm-hmm. But it's more isolated. It's well known by more machismo, machetes and guns and family feuds, cattle ranching. You know, that's how it's been portrayed through times. So that was not part of my plans, being a young physician, female and single, go to the Olancho area.
And you mentioned machismo. So this would be a community where women basically were subservient.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, in Latin America, it's been the tendency, but that particular area of the country, it's kind of more like that.
Yeah. In fact, there's a term in your book that says you wear your pants well, which Spanish equivalent basically says you walk the walk and talk the talk, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been a single, you know, and then I have to go to Olancho, you know, so I have to kind of learn how to live there.
Uh-huh. And in the Cayamel River Valley, which runs down, I guess, down to the Mosquito Coast on the east coast of Honduras, very rural, I assume a big disparity in incomes?
Yeah, very rural. Lack of accessibility, you know, even when people are hard workers and people can grow, it's more agriculture for subsistency, you know, that people cannot get their products out to the market. Very, very isolated. Actually, during the rainy seasons, we cannot get there by car. We have to walk or use horses. When the rivers goes up, just people cannot get out of there. And, you know, the people that live there as people with less resources, because this is the only type of land that they can afford. So those communities have been more isolated. That was one of the reasons why, at the beginning, this place was chosen to go and do medical work there.
Now, today, Predizan has how many clinics?
Today, we have 7 clinics way, way up in the mountains. We have an alcohol and drug rehab center in Catacamas. We do have a couple of clinics in the urban area in Catacamas, and we have one central medical clinic. It's called the Good Samaritan Family Health Center. And we have physicians there full-time, nurses. We have lab, pharmacy, diagnostic capabilities. We have ultrasound. We, in fact, are doing laparoscopic surgeries. We do have doctors from the capital of Honduras or the capital of the state of Olancho that come with different specialties to see patients. And we also receive medical brigades from the states that go and do surgeries. We receive at least 10 medical brigades every year so that we're able to serve the people that won't have other means to be served.
Now, how large an area is this area that you're serving? And you're, I guess, from what I understand, the only medical care in that whole area.
Yeah, well, Olancho is a state. It's one of the 18 states of Honduras. It's the largest one geographically, but it's a low population density. In fact, Olancho has been compared with the size of a country of El Salvador. Okay. So it's a large country. The mountain area where we work mainly, it has 53 small communities that have around 15,000 people. And then we serve the main area of Caracamas with the alcohol and drug rehab and the main clinic.
That's a city of what, 40, 50,000?
At least 80, close to 100,000 people. And we have the surgery room there, two surgery rooms, and the alcohol and drug rehab center in Caracamas. But with the alcohol and drug rehab center, we receive patients from all over the country. We have an inpatient facility, and it's been quite interesting. You know, sometimes we have received more recently patients from the United States. You know, the people who have come, the mojados, you know, the wetback people, and they cannot afford care in the States. So they have gone back and get treatment in our facility.
Now, a big part of this book, Lay Down Your Guns, describes some of the more recent developments in the Cuyamel River Valley. Give us a sense of how this community has changed over 20 years or so that you've been working with the people of the region.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of changes, and some of them really good, some of them not too good. And the positive side, you know, we have trained community healthcare workers. We have trained local people to be auxiliary nurses. We have trained health promoters. We have trained evangelists to do healthcare prevention, to do spiritual counseling.
So there's a lot of preventive care.
A lot of preventive
and,
care.
And little maintenance, medical maintenance, if
it's
you will.
It's more sustainable, you know, with the local people being trained. And one of the things that hasn't been too good, and I think this is not only for Honduras, but I mean the whole world in Latin America, you know, the use of drugs has increased, and drugs being manufactured in South America, Honduras geographically being located in the heart of Central America, is a good channel to pass drugs from South America to North America and Europe. So the Cuyamel area, you know, which kind of borders with the Mosquito Coast. There are several rivers, you know, the Patuca River, the Cuyamel River, the Huasparani River.
From the Cuyamel, you can go right down to the
you
ocean.
You can go right to the Patuca River and then to the ocean.
Yeah.
So those geographic locations have been attractive for people who are doing a drug pass, you know. So Honduras has, the whole Honduras has been used as a bridge between the north and the south. So that is something that has really affected our work in different ways. When you have people who have very little and you have people that will come and offer 50,000 lamps to transport this through this river, you know, and you're teaching them agriculture and you're going to make that profit maybe in a year or 2 years of work, you know. I mean, it's really hard.
You can make in a weekend what you make in a year.
Absolutely, yes. So that has been quite of a challenge. And we have had to deal with that. Also, violence had been a little bit higher there. There has been more local involvement, you know, in the trade, in the local business. And there's been different groups of people, you know. Some people have been very protective of their community, their land. And one of the strategies that cartels uses are they go and buy land, and they buy the land that is more appropriate for them to use the channels of transportation. So that has kind of provoked some problems, you know, within the local communities.
And really, the book details this sort of this sort of violence between a group coming in wanting to buy another family clan's land.
Yes.
They're not wanting to sell. and then they're at loggerheads, and very quickly erupts into violence.
Yes, it's part of the book. Yeah. And one thing that we have to do, we were just right there, and we coordinated a mediation committee, you know, between those two groups. You know, there was a time when the villages were being basically abandoned by people, you know, because there was so much danger. So we were able, with other local leaders and authorities and leaders from churches, to form a mediation committee and talk with them. Just, that's where it comes to lay down your guns, you know, because they were just kind of marching from one side to the other one and meet in one place, basically a war.
You were part of that mediation.
Yes,
and
yes.
In one hand, the local group you knew very well. You knew, I guess you'd been treating them sometimes since they were children.
Yes, yes. I think that was part of that was one of the pluses, you know, or one of the advantages, that we had been working with those communities for about 25 years. So some of the adults that were involved with this, you know, I have known them when they were children. So that kind of gave me a little bit of opportunity to just kind of walk more closer to
you've
them.
You've been telling them to open their mouth and say, ah, since they were little kids.
Yeah.
They might be a lot more likely to listen to you now.
Exactly. And I mean, there were some times, you know, when they were talking about killing all those many people. I say, I've known you, and I've known your parents. You're not killers. You know, what are you talking about? You want to kill people? This is not the way that you solve those problems, you know. So,
now, what about the outside group? How did you make connections with them?
Well, that's been more of a challenge. You know, because that's when it comes more dangerous, you know, because you have people that are not from the area. You have people who you don't know.
Or who might have no compunction of
mercenaries, you know, people who are being paid to do this kind of work. And that's where you have to really rely on God and a lot of wisdom, you know, and have people that you trust, people that you know, and that's been a good thing. And we've been able, I will say, have an opportunity to witness to people that you will never get in church. You know, we've been able to pray and to read the scriptures with people who are human beings that have been hurt, people who have pain, and people who feel like there hasn't been justice for them. You know, I remember one of the guys that I was talking with, and he says, I was telling him, you know, we're here because we care. We've been praying, and he was saying, you know, your prayers do nothing for us. You know, you can be in your churches praying, but who cares when my dad was killed? Who cares when my brother was killed? You know, so, and we have to apologize and say, you know, we're sorry. You know, we know that as Christians, we have to take a higher steps, you know, and it's not easy, and it's not without fear, you know, but I think whenever God gives us a task, He's also going to equip us to deal with it. And there were times I would say, you know, we apologize because our churches probably have not been doing all that we needed to do, you know. But I think handling things in this way, I don't think you're going to get your father back. I don't think your father or your son, whatever they are going to be proud of you when you're trying to solve the situation in this way. So let's try to find other ways to handle this situation, you know. So that was very challenging, very, very challenging. But at the same time, as I said before, gave us opportunities to witness. And at least during that time, I think we were able to stop all this, basically a local war that was going on.
And it was basically a retribution war. I think this outside group came in, tried to scare people off their land.
Yeah. Yeah,
they would end up in violence. There would be retribution against that group by the local folks, and it just was this circle of violence,
which
you know, that happens in our rural communities everywhere.
Happens everywhere in the world, you know, and that's one of the things that that I like to share with people in this country or any other country. You know, that human nature, you know, just at the end of the day, you know, we have the same heart. We hurt.
There's a reason why the eye for an eye saying has been around since,
absolutely,
you know, they could
yes,
chisel it into a stone tablet.
Yes. Yeah. But I think at the same time, you know, that's the reason why Jesus died.
Right.
And that's the reason why forgiveness exists, and how we have to be skilled, and we have to learn how to, not to say people, just forgive this, you know, when you know that you have to process, that there's a lot of stuff that need to be processed with them and support. And at the end, I felt like it was a privilege to really work with people that are in huge need and nobody would want to help them. Because, I mean, it's a scary, you know, it's a dangerous situation.
My guest today is Dr. Amanda Madrid. She's the executive director of Predazon, which works in eastern Honduras. It's a ministry and a medical series of medical clinics, but she's the subject of a local Tulsa minister's book, Greg Taylor, titled Lay Down Your Guns, One Doctor's Battles for Hope and Healing in Honduras. We've made these connections with these two groups. How did you get them a ceasefire in place, if you will? How did that go about happening?
Well, one of the things that we did was, it's described in the book, you know, we had to walk in the middle of hundreds of men arms, you know, and we have to just kind of go with, we're not a threat, you know, and I think it's a good thing I'm short and a woman, you know, so I'm not a threat for anyone. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm not a threat for them, you know, so I could just kind of walk there. And one of the things was to listen to them. And what is it you're wanting, you know? So we just kind of wrote down, you know, what is it they wanted. And then we did the same thing with the other group. We went and listened to them. And one important thing was to build trust. You know, we're not going to tell the other group what you're telling us. You know, we are here because we care. We're here because we want peace. We are here because, you know, your kids, your sisters, your mothers are hurting. People are leaving the villages. And we spent a couple of weeks, you know, just kind of going back and forth from one group to the other one. And then later on, they have a spokesperson for each group, a couple of spokespeople from each group. And then we met in the city in Caracamas, you know, and then, you know, we just kind of talked. And we were able to sign an agreement, you know, that they were going to stop the violence. And I don't mean this is over or it's fixed. But I think at least in this particular situation, people were able to come back to the villages. There was a time, you know, when schools were closed, clinics were closed, people were abandoning their families and their houses. And that all that is restored, you know.
Now, when you have two different groups like that, and one represents a drug trafficking organization of some sort, I think the tendency is to put a moral judgment on that other side. But of course, you can't bring that person to a negotiating table if you've already cast a moral judgment against those folks.
Exactly.
It sounds like you just kind of had to say, let's put all of that aside. Mm-hmm, let's mm-hmm. figure out why you two groups are trying to kill each
exactly,
other.
Exactly, exactly. And I think how there are probably some other interests that are beyond what is your principles or your family, your immediate needs that you need to look more toward instead of getting all the emotions and the power struggles there.
Mm-hmm. And that was possible?
Oh, yeah.
Now, was the government much involved or was this more a community sort of non-governmental mediation?
We did try to get the government involved. In fact, the Minister of Security in Tegucigalpa, he was very helpful. You know, we got the mayor of Caracamas, you know, involved. But it's very hard to get the authorities. And when you have politicians, you know, that have so much to lose, you know, they were helpful, but they didn't want to get too involved. You know, like nobody will want, even the police didn't want to go to the villages, you know, because it's mountains. And you don't know, and there have been histories in the past, you know, of violence against the police. So they were using that maybe as an excuse. Or a
lot of times
fear.
In a lot of remote rural areas, there's a fear or suspicion of any authority
exactly,
figures.
Exactly, exactly.
And I assume this is the same
That's
there?
That's the same, you know, and that was one of the things that we worked out. I found one police officer that was honest and good. And he went to the villages with me, and we talked with the villages, and he introduced himself, and he was very honest talking with the people about, you know, we as the police cannot solve this alone because, I mean, it's impossible for us to know all the ins and outs, you know, but if we have the community working with us, and that was very, very helpful. that was very helpful at the end.
Now, I'd imagine there are still instances where this truce breaks down momentarily, but is it still holding today for the most part?
For the most part, it is holding today, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, the big exploding at that time, you know. And I think one good thing that happened was that finally that issue was put on the table, and it just became part of the national news. And I will say that the general, the biggest officer of the police in Honduras, has been very sensitive and very active about doing something when it's needed. So it is much better today. I mean, I won't say it's done, it's over, you know, but the clinics are open. The schools
you had
are
to close
open.
Your, you had to close your clinics
yes,
at
we
one
did.
Point.
Yeah,
because
we
of
did
the
have to close.
So
yeah, yeah. In fact, one of the groups wanted to use one of our clinics as their camping site, you know. So that was something that made me furious. Say, you are not going to do that. You know,
sounds like you're a force to be reckoned with when it comes to these clinics.
Oh, well, you know, that's something that people need very much.
And so with this truce mostly holding, you had people return to their villages?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
A semblance of normality
exists
in the communities, commerce, mm-hmm. and the like.
People have come back to the villages.
Schools
and the
are, open.
Are open. Schools are open. You know, teachers came back. You know, there were some teachers that didn't want to come back to the villages. And so it's pretty much everything is more normal now.
And that's really interesting because a lot of times when somebody is forced off their sort of ancestral home, the tendency is to go to the big city and stay there.
Yeah.
You know, be it Tegucigalpa or mm-hmm. Catacombs. But people have gone back to their village.
Yeah. I mean, and some of that happened. You know, usually the immigration is kind of natural thing, you know, that especially
you
people with a higher
gravitate
education,
towards
you know,
this,
they gravitate
the city.
And go to the city. But at this particular time, you know, the people who were living the villages were the women, the children, the grandmothers.
Would these be farmers? Would they be
farmers? Yes.
Is this banana country?
Well, it's more like a subsistence agriculture. You know, they farm to live. And one of the times when we went to look for them, you know, when one of these things have happened, you know, there are people hiding in the boonies, you know, people injured, and people didn't want to just even get out of it. They will sleep in the jungle. But all that has changed, you know, that people went back to their homes, and I think the children are more comfortable going to school. It's much, much better.
Right. And you can focus again on healing.
Exactly.
And treating the population.
Exactly. We're working, we do work with the Ministry of Health, running those clinics, you know, the 7 clinics we have in the mountains. So we do treatment for, especially for mothers and children, you know, infant and maternal mortality are very high. So we do a lot of education. We do a lot of prenatal control, immunization for children, growth and monitoring control for children under 5. So all that is going on again, you know, so I just feel like that is something worthy to work for.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that. Amanda Madrid, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Amanda Madrid is the Chief Medical Officer and Director of the Christian Medical Ministry Predazan, which serves the mountainous region in eastern Honduras. She's also the subject of the book Lay Down Your Guns, One Doctor's Battle for Hope and Healing in Honduras, which is written by local Broken Arrow minister Greg Taylor. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cromley.
There's a lot of buzz and bleep these days about August Osage County, but I have discovered a different Osage country by another famous Oklahoma writer. It's a book I wish I had found decades ago. I think it takes a special gift to write well about place and geography. Has anyone ever written better about Montana and fly fishing in the big Blackfoot River than Norman McLean did in A River Runs Through It? And I don't think anyone could portray West Texas with such love and appreciation as Larry McMurtry does in his memoirs. My new favorite author writes eloquently about Oklahoma. He's John Joseph Matthews, who died in 1979, renowned for his books about the Osage people. Matthews was part Osage and grew up on the reservation. then went to Europe to be a fighter pilot in World War I, then to OU to get a degree in geology, then to study at Oxford. Then a failed marriage. Then the Great Depression knocked the wind out of his finances, and it knocked the wind out of him, too. He was about 40 when he came back to the Osage Prairies to live in solitude for a decade. He said, "I came to the Blackjacks to live, as one climbs out of a roaring stream of civilization onto an island to rest and to watch." He lived in a little sandstone cabin he called the Blackjacks, and he wrote. In 1945, his memoir, Talking to the Moon, was published. It's subtitled, Wildlife Adventures on the Plains and Prairies of Osage Country. But it is so much more than a memoir or a nature book. It is a poetic, spiritual storytelling book written by a philosopher deeply aware of a beautiful world of seasons and of a balance so easily destroyed by greed or war. Each chapter describes a month and is titled for the Osage moon of that month, such as the yellow flower moon or the deer hiding moon. When Matthews writes about an Oklahoma summer before air conditioning and degrees of 113, we swelter with him. When the first cold rain comes from the north with flocks of ducks on the wing, we share his soul-deep joy. He takes time to truly see the world that he shares with animals, the birds in their nests, rough cowboys, and the Osage elders with their dry humor. Matthews writes in a style that is both unadorned and yet musical, like this. He says some of the old hunters have nothing but keys and a knife to jingle in their pockets. When he watches a coyote hunting field mice, he says, "It stands on its hind legs like a fox in a fable." And when he watches butterflies, he says, "They float like the thoughts of a lively child." John Joseph Matthews, who was called Joe by his friends and family, was born in Pawhuska Indian Territory in 1894, about the same time as Oklahoma's famous historian Angie DeBow. They knew one another and admired one another. From today's vantage point, we can look at them both and say, what wonderful writers living and working in those little towns. But it wasn't easy for either of them, trying to make a living writing in the Great Depression and World War II. Money was scarce. The only thing they have plenty of was discouragement. But as Dr. DeBow told me once, even if nobody reads your books, you must keep writing them. They did. And now, 68 years after it was published, I have found Matthew's extraordinary book, Talking to the Moon. He died at age 85 and was buried beside the sandstone cottage in the Blackjacks he loved. Over the arched fireplace in his home, he had engraved, in Latin, this philosophy: to hunt, to swim, to laugh, to ride, that is to live. We should all love where we live as much as Matthews did. His love of Osage County makes me almost want to move back to my hometown in Nowata County. Almost.
Connie Cronley is the executive director of the nonprofit Iron Gate, a writer, an essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS and its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. You can also check out our website and see what else is going on around our town and around your station. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.